Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
February 7, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And I know that this is the show you were looking for because you can hear me knock on my mic stand. Anyway, it is a Monday, a moon day, whatever, the first broadcast day of the week for the O'Shelly Effect. And that means I'm going to get to kick it off with my friend Hesher here in the first hour, which he is regularly in this spot, although it seemed irregular for a little while. That was not intentional. So my friend Hesher is still here and thankfully able to do this with me tonight. In the second hour, we have the artist currently known as Terry Tapp, but no idea or possible precognition about what might occur in that hour, just letting you know right now. Could be a reading, could be something else. You never know. It's a little bit of a freelance situation on Monday, so never can tell. One thing I do is get the news together a little bit for Monday, at least try to inform you about the world that allegedly is, but, you know, some days I do better than others, I know this. Anyway, Hesher, Alternate Current Radio, that is your home spot, alternatecurrentradio.com. Of course, that's the home of what? The Odd Man Out, right? Let's see, The Daily Ruckus, The Sunday Wire, The Boiler Room, The Social Rejects Club. I know I'm forgetting people. Oh, The Mystical American Patriot Society?
And Soul Purpose, our buddy Mindspace Art. He's got a relatively new show there called Soul Purpose also.
Oh,
and, of course, all our mixtapes on Saturdays, yeah.
Cool, Soul Purpose. I like that. So is it spelled like S-O-U-L, Purpose?
Oh, you know it.
Okay, you know what?
Yep.
Something new for me to check out. Who's the host of that show?
That is our friend Mindspace Art. He goes by the handle of Mindspace Art, and it's a great show. He's really into his craft, and he's the guy that helps us with our video editing as well. He is a master video editor also. He's from his site is West Lexicon Media out there on all the social media pages.
Cool. Okay. Well, I you know what it is? I heard you say that to begin with, and I wasn't sure that was the host's name. Mindspace Art. No, but can you just call him Art for short when you talk to him or what?
Yeah, he'll take that. Or Mindspace, whatever.
Or Mindspace. I don't know. Mindspace is a way cooler name. See, I couldn't think of an inventive radio name. That's why I used my own. I didn't have a good one. It's a lack of imagination, truly. It was like, first of all, I figure, screw it. They're going to figure out who I am eventually anyway, someday. So I don't care. Let them know. And also, I don't really have anything better. So I chose something that I knew nobody would copy. Anyway, Hesher. I have seen another Hesher somewhere. We did talk about that at one point. There was a character in a movie, but maybe we got other things to get to. Good to check in with you, though, and see that things are developing. I have a new show, but I'm not allowed to reveal who it is that's going to be hosting very soon. Should be toward the end of February or the beginning of May, or excuse me, March. February to March. Yeah, okay. Keeping my stuff straight. End of February or beginning of March, we'll have a new show, which will be entirely different from everything else on the network. I am creating an eclectic space of misfit toys that are all on the island called O'Shelly that happen to be radio hosts. So, you know, working on it, not doing quite as well as you, but trying. Anyways.
Hey, it's a grind. It is a grind, man. It's like herding cats, including myself.
Well, you know, first of all, you got to control yourself, and that can be a full-time job for some of us, and I think you and I have had time periods in our life where that was two full-time jobs. You know, sometimes you got to learn from your reckless youth, or maybe just learn to get a little less damaged as you're being reckless. Anyhow, let's just get to some of the news that allegedly is, if you don't mind.
Yeah, let's hear it, man.
Let's start with the stupidest thing I could find. Spotify, right, is now removing some Rogan episodes because of the N-word. I said that. So anyway, apologies back and forth, the CEO and everybody talking about exactly how financially tied Spotify is to Joe Rogan, because, you know, he had a $100 million deal with them, or still does. You know, not exactly the outside of the mainstream guy when you're getting $100 million. But anyway, look at his logo. Make decisions for yourself. Okay, let's move forward. I might get back to Rogan later. It is what it is. Let's see, Trump and his records and what's going on there. And they had to get 16 boxes from Mar-a-Lago to return them to the National Archives. A sort of non-story, but weird. And I got to tell you, I got mixed feelings about it, only in as much as this. The papers that a president creates while in office belong to guess who? The people that paid him, which is you and me. They're supposed to be stored at the National Archives. And I've had this complaint about, guess what, the past four presidents for sure, not entering everything into the National Archives. So I'm not surprised, although allegedly the letters between him and Kim Jong-un were also part of what had to be collected from Mar-a-Lago, which makes it interesting to me. But other than that, I think it's a non-story. I think they're trying to fold it into other things, and here we go again.
Letters? Like him and Kim are like writing handwritten letters to each other or something? What do they mean, letters?
Yeah, remember when Trump said, we fell in love. He wrote me a letter. We fell in love. Remember that whole silliness?
Okay. Oh, we're pen pals.
Yeah, so they were like exchanging letters at a certain point. And believe it or not, that stuff becomes public property when you leave office. Even the weird back channel thing that Kennedy had with Castro, you know, right before he was killed, that whole thing. And, like the record of it as it existed, which was sparse, and also his letters with Khrushchev, which were not publicly known at the time he was in office. Well, they do become known. They become part of the National Archive. Anything you do as president while you're in that office, you're supposedly at the job of doing the people's business. So,
is that only for handwritten stuff? Like, does it change when email comes in? I mean, I'd love to see everybody's 4 to 8 year email records, if possible.
No, see, that is the challenge I've been waiting to see how the National Archives is going to deal with. Because, frankly, in the Trump era, you know, you realize, I mean, Obama was like the first Twitter president, really. And then Trump took it to another level because constant tweets, right? So you got 4 years worth of tweets. And possibly you could say that during the presidential campaign, there is a historical record there that needs to be collected. I mean, I'm trying to be totally vanilla about this. No conspiracy.
Yeah, me too. I just want to understand this. What about all the tweets that Twitter removed of his? Maybe they should have been held for posterity, or is there like a presidential archive wayback machine that needs to be installed here?
Well, all of that stuff as it's happening is supposed to be retained and preserved. Even the digital, the electronic, all of it.
I'm going to cry false and fake and just a total scam on this whole thing. There's no way. They're showing us stuff that hasn't been curated and or just placed there to, you know, prop up narratives and stuff. There's no way. I'm not buying this.
Oh, no. I'm just telling you the official explanation of what should be done, allegedly.
No, I agree. That is how it should be done. These are our employees, allegedly, so we should be able to audit them fully.
Mm. Totally understand. And I think in stages too, because there are some things that obviously should not just go out into public domain right away. Again, vanilla, surface level, no conspiracy implied or anything like that. You would say that there's a reason to keep certain things redacted for the time being. For national security. That could be a legitimate explanation, although it's been highly abused over the years. That could be an official explanation, which means eventually they still get curated by the National Archives and put away, supposedly, but they're not to be revealed for X amount of years. This I understand, but still, retention is the issue here, where I'll tell you, in the past four administrations, I know for a fact that there were problems with retaining the documentation. So, you know, is it the task that they're overwhelmed by, or is it the task that they really don't want to do but allegedly do?
Yeah.
It's an open debate.
Let's also not forget that we are now a country that will go occupy another country for over 20 years. If you look at the whole Afghanistan fiasco, it would have been nice if maybe 7 years into that, some of those communications, the actual raw communications, were released. Even if they were curated, I imagine it might have convinced people that, hey, this isn't the greatest idea. What is all this about? I mean, could you imagine 7 years in if a whole data dump had happened? It's like, okay, yeah, that stuff, it's expired. It's a national security thing. But no, we'll wage a occupy or a war in a country for 20, 21 years and just not tell anybody, you know. Well, and what's our debt up to now? Like $30 trillion? I think it was like there was like a couple trillion dollars missing and a big fat debt when 9/11 happened. And now here we are post-Afghanistan in the middle of the pandemic industrial complex and the war against the virus. Right. How long is that one going to go?
Well, that's the other thing, is how long are we going to, you know, have to wait to get the actual documentation regarding the behavior of this administration currently and last regarding this situation? Because don't forget, didn't start under Biden, but, you know, so you need access to both administration stuff in order to get a picture here. But will we have that within the next 50 years? I don't think so. You know, and a fair question there with Afghanistan, because let's get to it. How long after 9/11 did we invade Afghanistan? Almost immediately, because the first planes flew and did bombing sorties, what, within a couple of days? So you're telling me that all the way back to 2001, sometime around, say, I don't know, 2010, 2012, they couldn't have started releasing more of this stuff that would have given us an idea about how that occupation started? Yeah, but they didn't, did they?
They ramped it up. They gave us Bin Laden. They're like, oh, here, check it out. We got this crazy story for you about Bin Laden. Okay, guys, I guess we're still buying that one too, but yeah, you know, instead of any sort of like, oops, maybe we weren't exactly right about this guy, it was like, here's a dubious case of him, you know, being taken out by SEAL Team 6 and then dumped at sea while we're all lied to and told that that's something normal for his culture. What a joke.
Yeah, that was the weirdest thing to me, is I don't remember in, you know, Muslim... In Muslim tradition, where the ocean was even present. You know, anyway, burial at sea, yeah, that comports with... No, it doesn't. Anyhow,
yeah, right off the back of an aircraft carrier. That's just, you know...
Well, you know, there's aircraft...
Standard.
Yeah, there's aircraft carriers in the Quran, Asher. I mean, read a book. Just saying. Yeah. Anyway, go back to this other thing, though. Look, there's a whole other conflict everybody forgets about, and that is, in my estimation, the illegal and immoral destruction of a sovereign nation under false pretenses that we call, what, the Iraq War. Oh, wait a minute, that didn't even really happen, did it? Yeah, it did.
Right.
But, you know, pay no attention to that either, right, Hesher?
Oh, no. I mean, hey, at least when it was Iraq, they rolled out Colin Powell, you know, and he had his little vials of powders and his intelligence reports about Viagra gangs and people that were smashing incubators with premature babies and, you know, WMDs, of course. Like, that was, you know, that got people. That was like, oh, people like, oh, no. Oh, hell no. We're not standing up for that. You know, we better get in there and make sure we destroy that place and have that guy, you know, taken out in the streets and butchered. But, hey, now they don't even bring out, like, a general or anything anymore. They just bring out a State Department spokesperson to say, yeah, there's going to be, you know, this is going to happen. And they're like, reporters are like, why? What proof do you have? He's like, I just told you. And they're like, no. You said there was intelligence or a report. And he's like, yeah, I'll give you the transcript of this this talk we're having right now afterward. It's like, what happened to having like a you know, a boss looking general come out and tell you this stuff. Now we just get these emaciated.
Oh, somehow I lost Hesher. I don't know how that happened. He was making a good point. Excuse me, good point though. Tell you what, let me go to a quick break and see if I can reconnect with our friend Hesher. Hold on. So, rejoining the live broadcast, because somehow we lost Hesher really quickly there, but I wanted to get him back because he was making a spectacular point about the emaciated, you know, general undersecretary, who cares what his name is, guy that comes out in a cheap suit to tell you, I'm telling you what the intelligence says. Well, what's your proof? And this is an AP reporter asking him, what's your proof? Well, I just told you. Yeah, that's you telling me something. That's not proof. That's not evidence. This is the
such
argument.
Such an amazing clip. Yeah. I loved it. That was just like the most blatant display of how far down we've gone. It's like it used to take a military officer in a congressional setting to convince everybody, and now you just bring up some emaciated dweeb in a cheap suit and with a plastic smile who will just look right in your face and know that. He's lying to you and not care. It's just, I don't understand that.
Well, see,
that soulless.
Yeah, and like I said,
what is that?
See, and like I said, at least they used to do the whole, listen, it's classified right now. You know, an explanation that says, I'm not going to tell you, and even though I know you're probably BSing about it's classified, at least say something like that. It's classified. We cannot reveal our movements beforehand. Something like that. Like you said, it would be better if you heard it from a general than, you know, the guy that's the vice principal of the nearby Catholic school. I mean, for real, this is not correct. This is exactly the guy who is not necessarily even a Catholic school, by the way. Let me not even be that particular about it. How about your local private school, whatever? Okay, the vice principal, not the guy who's even in charge, the guy who works for the guy in charge, okay? That's who it looks like. Is coming out there and not even really. I don't know what to say anymore. It's just, you know, like how do you? I'm the authority. I just told you, so therefore I've given you the evidence. So you're.
Yeah. Oh, and I loved his other comeback too, which was, well, if you don't want to believe the illustrious governments of the UK and the US, then fine, go ahead and you know. Take solace in Putin's narrative. And then there was another gal that was talking to Saki earlier that day, and she got told, fine, if you want to don't believe me, then just go get some news from ISIS, you know, believe ISIS's news. Like, what, this, we're at like fifth grade level argumentation here from, you know, the power structure. It's so weird.
I don't have to shut up. When I look at you, I want to throw up. So why don't you grow up?
Right.
I mean, that's weird. Anyway, you know what's funny about that is that today, and I think it's the same guy, but again, they're so blurry as far as, you know, having no character or anything. I think it's the same guy. It might have been Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. Might have been. Now, the only reason why I might know that vaguely, and I could be exactly wrong, because honestly, a lot of white people look alike. And the thing is that then this guy is clearly one of those kind of guys. John Kirby, was that racist, Hesher?
No. And you're right. If you're okay. The other guy you're thinking of is Ned Price, I believe, who was okay. In it with Matt Lee the other day. And Ned Price is like the new John Kirby, as far as I can tell. They could be clones or cousins or brothers or something like
just,
that. I call Ned Flanders, though. He reminds me a little bit more of Ned Flanders.
Well, but see, Flanders would at least go, Oakley Doakley, why don't you, you know, I mean, you know, you do the, well, we wouldn't want to get any people upset about the narrative, you know.
Right,
he would be entertaining.
Ned Flanders wouldn't lie, though. Ned Flanders, as far as I can remember, is not the lying type, you know. He's a man of God and all that stuff.
You know, but, what? That's a good point. But John Kirby today wanted to come out and make it very clear that, you know, Putin is the aggressor and all that. And I thought it might be the same guy because they just sort of blend together after a while. Again, you're probably correct about the ID, but I can't swear to it either because, again, no standout. They're just sort of generic. Generic, that's the term I was looking for. And, of course, Putin came out today to say exactly the opposite, that NATO is the aggressor. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, it reminds me of the old Soviet stuff where it was like, you are indeed the aggressor. No, sir, you are the aggressor. It's just less intense. It's less entertaining. Nobody's banging their shoe on the gavel thing at the UN saying they're going to bury us without a shot. No, that's not happening. It's just blah.
Right. Is it happening over Twitter? I mean, are we going to get to the point where these are just tweets going back and forth? Because it feels like that's kind of where our government, debate has descended into.
Yeah, right. I mean, look, despite all the pressers today over this and that, and Biden's meeting with, Germany's chancellor, and Putin's meeting with Macron, and honestly, this is all the puppet show. This is all the puppet show. It doesn't speak to what's really happening still. Anyway, you know what? Speaking of stupid things that happen in public, I know you like this one. I love how Stacey Abrams cannot stop shooting herself in the foot despite the fact that she's against guns. Because she goes to a class to do a photo op. They've clearly laid it all out. She's not wearing a mask. All the little kiddies are. And what is her defense? You people are attacking me because Black History Month or something. And I just, it's like, no, we're attacking mask hypocrisy. And at the end of the day, honestly, if you land on the mask doesn't matter, then the mask doesn't matter. She is so, so bad at trying to be opposition. I don't get it. I just don't get it. She's clearly going to lose in the governor's race again. And clearly the Libertarian candidate's going to take their 1% home. And whoever the Republicans run, well, next governor of Georgia, I promise you. She is pointless as a candidate, period. Anyway, you want to talk about other pointless stuff? Just in media news? How about this one? Hesher, let's see what you think of this. you notice the guy at CNN, the head guy over there, Jeff Zucker, well, he had to resign. Did you catch that whole story recently?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did, man. Yeah, kind of reminded me. Go ahead. What do you think about that one, man? I did follow that one a little bit.
Okay, I'll hit you with this. It is the Fredo that keeps on giving. Okay, the embarrassing Italian list. I go to it again with the Cuomos. Chris Cuomo, who was on there, I generally refer to him as Meathead. You know, hey, let's get to it. This is the real deal. I'm a lawyer. Chris Cuomo. I'm a lawyer, and in fact, I'm going to turn around and help my brother with his sexual harassment problems and also try and report on it at the same time because that's ethically sound. Good idea there. They had to get rid of him finally. But he's the gift that keeps on giving because this Zucker thing, he had a consensual relationship with some female coworker. And, you know, that used to be called just meeting people, by the way. I know, you know, you're not supposed to abuse the power dynamic of PC. I know. But truthfully, you met people at work, you met people at work. And it used to be called discretion. Okay, when you didn't, tell everybody. But now the guy who's the head of the network resigns. I mean, I don't feel bad for him, but, you know, what the hell? Keep your, discretion is the better part of valor. Not if you work for the Coronavirus News Network. And I'll tell you something else. It makes no sense. It would have never been discovered, though, without people having to double check on what Meathead Cuomo was doing. So Fredo keeps on giving, not only to his own family, who, by the way, notice that Andrew Cuomo did exactly what I said he would do, which is end up with no sort of real penalty for anything. On the one hand, on the other hand, some of the allegations were a little suspicious. But I don't know if we're looking at a political hit, elites acting stupidly, I mean, or all of the above. But no criminal consequences, whereas other people get punished for, you know, using the wrong tone or pronoun. So I don't know. I don't know. But I will tell you that it's a gift that keeps on giving because moral platitudes and all, they've got no right to any of the high ground. And CNN, come on. What are your thoughts, Hesher?
Oh, man. All right. I think sex scandals are a total smokescreen, you know, at this point, especially when it comes to someone like this guy and the network he's been running. The amount of documented lies that this dude has pushed. I think all these people, all these presidents of these media companies should be most likely in jail for what they've done. You know, so to me, it's just it was kind of like the same with Cuomo. You know, he was responsible for thousands of people's deaths because of the way that he responded to the corona thing. And what did he go out in? He went out in a sex scandal, too. A sex scandal is a giant nothing these days. I mean, look at the kind of lifestyles they promote on all popular culture now. I mean, it's all degenerate sex stuff. It's all alcohol 24/7 and pills and drugs and pharmaceuticals and adultery and all this stuff, you know. It's like that, that no one under 60 gives a crap about sex scandals these days. And it's like CNN, I mean, what we've learned in the last 6 months, this guy Benny tweeted this out, I'll read it. What we learned about CNN in the past 6 months: one, the president of CNN cheats on his wife with subordinates and covers it up; two, CNN employed multiple pedophiles; three, CNN's top anchor intimidated, covered up sexual abuse victims; and CNN still employs a serial public masturbator. I like that. That was a good tweet there.
That's
Benny
pretty
Johnson.
Good summation.
I don't know who you are, but I like that tweet.
That is a pretty good summation, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know what? Half of the stuff on that list, I don't care about. Do I care if a guy is having an affair on his wife if he's running the news network? No, I don't.
Show me a workplace that is not happening at.
And in some cases, almost unbelievably, like you can't even imagine.
Seriously, I mean, that was life in any workplace, almost. And it still is, I would wager. If I was in one, there'd be someone doing that. A whole bunch of people doing that.
Go to your local grocery store. I promise you, the manager of that store at some point has, like, I don't know, been with some of the girls that work in the deli. I'm serious. I mean, promise you, there's been cashiers that left because the assistant manager broke up with them. Check it out. I'm serious. Go ask. Go ask one, you know, place where you know the people that work there. And see, you know what? Is this kind of thing ever? They'll tell you that, and that's a grocery store. Got it? I mean, really. What are we talking about? Real world. I'm not saying people should abuse people or do the whole, you know, sleep with me or you don't have a job. I mean, that kind of stuff, yeah. People need to get punished for that. That's wrong. But, I mean, the fact that people are going to interact, meet with each other, and decide to hook up, whether they're violating their own vows or not, none of my business. And none of anybody else's business. I mean, outside of, you know, what? Them, their significant others, and God. They can figure it out. I don't have time for this. So I don't understand why it's an issue. Well, when it comes to this other stuff, it's pretty interesting. The pedophile thing, that's weird because they found producers and all this other stuff doing all kinds of dirty things. I mean, it's just, it's a mess, man. So speaking
of...
It
is. And Don Lemon is next. They're coming after Don Lemon. They don't talk about it much, but he's got some sort of sexual misconduct suit going against him right now. That's
he's got
not...
a couple of them.
Yeah, and you know, they've been saying that they're going to have a new president coming in anyways, and you know, I think this is all part, this is like the softball destruction of CNN here, because it's already a trashed brand, and they're going to have to rebrand it, and they're going to get rid of all these people, but they're going to get rid of them in the quietest way possible. So, you know, with Zucker, it's like, oh, well, we don't want to see Zucker, you know, up on treason charges or something. You know, if we were to really have access to all his emails too and figure out who the heck, you know, what NGOs and pharmaceutical companies he's been talking to and what those discussions are like and what their lawyers' discussions are like and
right.
The things that make the money go around. No, we're not going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about how his network, along with the rest of them, destroyed everybody's businesses and ruined people's lives and, you know, through the last 2 years with this garbage that they've been spewing at us. No, we can't have that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So let's give them a little sex scandal here. Oops, forgot to divorce your wife and sign the paperwork with HR. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me, folks? Do you think that the president of CNN is subject to the same stupid slave rules that you're subject to, you know, in whatever industry you work in. Yeah, you may get treated that way. You may lose your job and your wife that way. But this guy, he does not live by the same rules as us.
Well, no, and this was the same point, by the way, in case anybody thinks I'm just making this, you know, open season on liberals. This is the same point I made about the Fox News scandal bundle that happened, yeah, where Roger Ailes, look, he's an elitist like Zucker, maybe more so. And you know what? He was abusing people. That makes perfect sense to me. I'm sure that was part of reality. There's been plenty of women came out, said he did this, that, third thing. And then what was it, Bill O'Reilly, and I don't remember who else they had to go after. There were lawsuits, everything. This always comes up at a time when it is time to clean house. So this is just what happens. Here's the excuse to get rid of these people. But really, I suspect on all angles, no matter what side of the political aisle you're on, the reason why you do this is so that you can protect the real dirt. And that's what I think happened here every single time. And I do mean it. It's across the board. This is the way, ready, corporate media functions. Anyways, I don't know what you think about all that, but not you, Hesher. I know what you think about it. You just told me. But I mean, I don't know what you guys out there think about it, but I got to remind you about something else, too, since we're talking sex scandals. You know, the Ghislaine Maxwell thing. Where is that going next? And is the limited hangout done hanging out? I don't know. I saw a discussion panel on. I'm going to include a link with the show notes from at least two guys that I found really interesting. One of them I had a report on the case on the show, Marlon Ettinger and Joseph L. Flatley. And there's a third guy I don't even recognize or remember his name. But there was a little roundtable discussion about where's this going to go from here? I know you guys got a lot of thoughts, but remember, a little bit of slash and burn is usually followed by a lot of cover-up and, you know, disconcern, okay? You get rid of it after a bit. You do the sacrificial lamb, and then you say the gods have been satisfied. Move on. That is the way this usually works. So, I don't know. There might be more to come out of the whole Ghislaine thing, but who knows? I think she'll survive prison. But sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But wasn't it convenient how we got into this whole 24/7 Ukraine Russia hysteria? Like just as that was starting to get interesting there with that juror who it turned out maybe shouldn't have been a juror, and all these strange things going on there, and maybe some new pleas going to be put in, and I don't know. It just seems really weird to me. And also, of course, Twitter started removing the accounts of the people that were following it the most cogently. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's people should be very dubious of the way that story has kind of just disappeared.
Well, I think it also links to the fact that you have a member of the royal family who is now actually threatened by lawsuits. And yeah. Simultaneously, what do you get for your Anglophiles out there? Well, Camilla is now going to be legitimately considered to maybe take the throne if Charles becomes king. Da, da, da. Are you enjoying that reality show of reptiles? I don't know what to tell you about that, but I found that interesting because always thought that was like that line there they weren't going to go for, is that the you know, the previous mistress who he had married and legitimized was not going to be legitimate among us. But, you know, we'll see how that goes, I guess, right? but meanwhile, don't lose sight of the fact that you got Prince What's-His-Name over there, one of the two bald princes, you know, it caught up, for real. They took away some of his titles and all that stuff. Now, will that end up in any sort of, like, jail time for the Blue Blood? I doubt it. Anyway. let's see, Representative Kinziger today said something of interest, and usually I sleep through his news clips and flashes, but gotta say I found it interesting that this guy was saying quite bluntly that he felt as though we needed to worry about an upcoming civil war in this country, and he said it repeatedly across different networks, and I'm wondering why that message is being pushed at the moment. But you know, should we continue to pay attention to that? because after all, the U.S. assessment of what's going on at the borders of Ukraine are that Putin is about ready and almost has every single thing in place to invade. And that's going to be a big story because, you know, you only care about the Ukraine when it's time to care about the Ukraine. But that's an interesting thing. And I don't believe it's going to be the wag the dog scenario that some people do. Because they're also simultaneously trying to reboot the now defunct reality TV series called The War on Terror. So I say stay tuned there because ISIS will always get itself another leader, even though it was supposedly destroyed, just like Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi had to die, what, 6 times? So, you know, introducing new characters coming to a political theater near you. I think the War on Terror is going to have a sequel. And if they can't sell you that, trust me, they'll come up with something else. But Ukraine, it is an insurmountable mess. And here we go. What are they going to wag the dog with? Oh, also, just in masking news, since I'm crunching up my papers now and just thinking about the things that I was also going over, the 3 states that are now looking to lift mask mandates and people are now going against them, even though they were supposed to be the ones that were all in on it, and all this other madness. I got to tell you, it's interesting when I see New Jersey as one of those places, because I thought Governor Murphy there was absolutely not going to budge on any of this stuff. And apparently, somebody talked a little bit of sense to him that said, you know, maybe we shouldn't have these kids masked up in school all day, because it doesn't make enough sense to do so. But I guess we'll see. I guess we'll see, and we'll see what people are going to continue to put up with, because after all, let's not forget the other twisted narrative of the day, and that is the truckers in Canada. And before I say anything about that, Hesher, just in general, what are your thoughts on the little trucker movement in Canada?
I'm for it. I have no problem with it. I think they need to be careful about what kind of circles they run in, because this is the kind of thing that's, you know, will draw some shady characters sometimes. But the sheer amount of citizenry that are supporting them is pretty inspiring. I saw some side-by-side video of the pro-trucker locations and rallies versus the anti, you know, the counter protests, the people that are, you know, wearing masks and saying get out of my city and that kind of stuff. And it was pretty staggering. I mean, you know, tens of thousands of people versus maybe 100 or so people, and the tens of thousands, they seemed happy. They all had their Canadian flags out. Mm-hmm. They were very united in the F. Trudeau sort of memeing that they were doing. There were all different kinds of people, all different races and ages, children, you know, adults, all different kinds, vaxxed, unvaxxed, mm-hmm. so-called. So, yeah, that's all great. And, you know, now they're inspiring other people in other countries. So there's similar things that are kicking off in other countries. But I spoke with Mark Anderson last week, and we were talking about the narrative, like taking over the narrative. Like, you can take over a location and you might even be able to cause enough of a stir to get the person out of office that you blame, you know, your grievances on. But the you know, he and I maintain that the real problem here is that the mass media is in control of the narrative, and that you know, if you're going to encircle parliament or whatever, you might want to, you know, point some of your attention at you know, your local CNN or your local BBC or one of these places that have mm-hmm. been pushing the lies that make this sort of tyranny actually happen. Because, you know, you can go, maybe you get Trudeau out, but who do you get next? You get some other, you know, World Economic Forum ghoul who's, you know, masquerading as a less bad option, when really it's just the same option with a different flavor. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with it. And I hope that they stay there for a whole 2 weeks to flatten the curve of tyranny, if you get my drift.
No, I got you. And the thing is, it may be the CBC you got to consider, but I'm sure they're also infiltrated by American media. And speaking of the word infiltrated, that's another problem here, because I do remember some other kind of trucker rally that once took place that got hijacked by some people. I do remember some other rallies that took place that got hijacked by some other people. I do remember a bunch of things that were meant to be laid out there for people to participate in that were actually completely fictitious, and people tried scams. Now, I'm not saying that the truckers that are doing this right now are those people, but if they make the wrong allies, they may end up with people like that among them. So they need to be careful of that.
Yeah, dude, check this out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. You're right. Check this out. Someone sent me an article. Thanks, whoever that was. And it was like the headline was Justin Trudeau's former sniper working security, new security chief for the truckers or something like that. Like, you get people like that coming into a movement and good people with honest intentions in mind start looking up to people like that. Mm. And, I'm not trying to... And this is a muddy area because you'll find, people like that sometimes that are honest, but oftentimes you'll find people like that that are not honest, and they start planting, seeds of destruction in your movement. And it can be a mess. And here's another example. The media will do setups too. The mass media will show up there. I got another picture of what has become memed out as a Fed boy now, FEDBOI. That seems to be what all the young media maniacs are calling it when media infiltrators and feds show up to try to do media ops, because this is something that's common. We've seen it over and over again for the last 12 years or longer since I've been paying attention. Mm-hmm. And there are hallmarks of it. There's all kind of examples of it. But anyway, I saw this one photo that was taken like a wide shot from a citizen journalist or just, some Joe or Jane with a phone. And it was like it was one guy standing amongst that had ran in amongst the truckers. And he's standing there with a Confederate flag. And there's another, there's a guy with a $3,000 camera like right up on him getting that big featured image that goes with it. And it's like the rest of the crowd, and there's video of the rest of the crowd going Fed, Fed, Fed. Like, the crowds are getting good at catching these people now. But the problem is, and this is why I say they got to take control of the narrative if they want these things to go anywhere, because the problem is those ghouls at the CBC or wherever, they'll take that picture. They'll run the worst headline they possibly can. They'll say white supremacist extremists, a fringe minority in trucker protest, blocking roads and stopping ambulances. That's just an example I pull off the top of my head for something they might say. Right. And then they've got this great, 50 millimeter photo off a $3,000 camera of some Fed boy with his Chinese made Confederate flag, and the damage is done because all these dum-dums out there see the headline, they see the picture, and they go, well, of course, everybody put your blue masks on and get these people out of here.
Well, and here you go. I remind people that this works both ways, where, occasionally you see anarchists wearing uniforms. This is not correct, I'm just saying, not everybody all shops at the same shoe shop unless they're buying things for a group, and that's usually what an organization like, the cops do. Stuff like this, I'm just saying. It is, there's a wide array of possibilities for infiltration and therefore a demolition from within. So I urge caution. I also drop the most interesting headline of the past couple of days on this into the chat room at Ocelli.com, which is Freedom Convoy counter-protester gets hit by truck in absurd display of crisis acting. Okay, which... There you go. That encompasses it all. Look at the article. Judge it for yourself. And also, look at the video that they're pointing to here of these people getting allegedly hit by a truck. they just missed
so
one
ridiculous.
Word. It's bad acting. See, if a crisis actor is good at it, it'll take you a while to figure it out. But these guys, clearly, they didn't pay, for the A-list crisis actors.
And you can't, man, when you've got that, that's the thing. We've seen the small versions of this try to pop up in the past over much smaller issues and saw them get really weird, but this is a convoy that at one point was like 79 kilometers long or something like that. This, and it's decentralized. As far as I can tell, all the communications are happening on Telegram and Signal and social media. You know what I mean? Like, there are a couple of, like, you know, social media star type of people who have, you know, come up as good speakers in it, and maybe a couple of those might be dubious. I don't know one way or the other, but, like, this thing is not like the piddly little movements that we've seen in the past. This is way too big to be you know, totally subverted. At least that's my opinion at this point. And that's the cool thing about it. It's like that they have to deal with it in a different way, because it's a number of people and supporters from a broad, you know, section of Canadians that they have to do media psyops to basically try to paint it the way that the government wants to paint it, which is a fringe minority of extremists with unacceptable views. And obviously that's not what it is. When I've got multiple listeners in Canada sending Instagram pictures of them and their kids out there doing it, and their husbands and their coworkers and all kinds of people, you know, it's pretty impressive. And I got to admit, when it first started happening, I didn't even want to look. I was like, ah, trucker protest, no thanks. But then just got too big to ignore. I started looking at it, and it's like, wow, this is something.
It is something. And again, you know, I know some people say, well, it's too big, they can't possibly. Oh, contraire. You know, there was this little thing called the Tea Party at one point. Okay, in the United States. And I contend that the intelligence agency said, oh no, we're not going to allow that to be. And infiltrated and had it, you know, shuttled or shunted, so to speak, into the GOP, as opposed to allowing it to be the freestanding movement it was to begin with. Warts and all, it ended up being subverted and ended up being absolutely hijacked. And I do believe that it was straight up publicly displayed intelligence assets that turned the table on that thing. So, you know, even if they establish themselves as the trucker party, even if they go in there and they have a huge organization, and there is a significant minority in Canada willing to stand up and speak against whatever it is they think is tyrannical to their liking, it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's not going to come along and set up some stuff that will go off in time. May not be instantly noticeable, but, you know, I just say, caution, people, that's all. Am I in support of it, generally speaking? Yeah. But then again, I've been in support of things like Occupy, too, and I watched that get infiltrated and absolutely turned on its head and turned into a pointless mess, which is one of the tactics. But, you know, another one is to dip people in things like racism, or dip them in some other sort of violence that is not something that they actually participated in, but they were in proximity to. And, you know, take out a few key people that seem to be pushing the narrative oh so well. And the next thing you know, a movement like this collapses. It just happens. So, you know, and I'm not saying that any of these other things I mentioned were all clean to begin with. I'm just saying that there was a legitimate amount of people that invested themselves one way or another in different movements which certainly wished to change the status quo one way or another. And the status quo usually finds a way to defend itself. So you must be on guard. Is that a fair enough statement, Hesher, or you think I'm out of line?
No. I think you're being fair there. And I'll counterbalance that a little bit just for a moment by bringing up the financial support aspect of it. GoFraudMe, as they've now been called, they collected almost $9 million in support within a matter of a few days. And then they closed the account, offered to return everybody's money, donated a bunch of money to some stupid cause. And but now there's another company, like a GoFundMe sort of clone that it's owned by a Christian people or something like that, and it's sort of oriented towards supporting those communities. I've never heard of it before. I really can't speak to it. But anyways, they made over $2 million within the first 24 hours. Like, this is just all public support pouring in for it, you know? So the amount of – like, you got the amount of people there. You got the amount of truckers there. The length of these convoys – and then just the amount of public financial support that's coming in. I mean, it's really unprecedented.
No, it does appear to be a legitimate movement, but it doesn't mean that it can't pick up some, you know, unfortunate, what shall we call them, along the way. Parasites. that either will, for their own financial gain, which you and I have been personally privy to that, where somebody has personally gone in to go gain something for themselves. And then there's other agents provocateur that will show up because that's their job. So just saying, be on the lookout, be vigilant regarding this. And let's see if we can't allow the people's voice to get louder like it should be all along, regardless. And I'm not even saying I necessarily agree with every single thing they're saying, but the fact is that the will of the people is something that I'm always in support of, as long as it's legitimate. And so there you have it. Anyway, we're actually down to like the last 8 minutes here, Ash.
Man, that went fast.
That went really quick, didn't it? So we wound up talking a little more about truckers than I thought we would, but what the hell, that's where it came from today. Anything else on your mind, though, before I close out this hour?
Well, let's see here. You had mentioned the whole idea of governors pushing gun control, and we got... I just don't understand why anyone running for governor or mayor of anywhere in this country at this point, after the amount of fear that was just, you know, waterboarded into everybody's third eye via CNN, who we discussed earlier, and other, you know, Fox, all of them, the entirety of both sides of the mass media cartel, and also a whole bunch of pseudo mass media cartel and pseudo alt media. I just don't understand, you know, and the number of firearms purchased since summer of 2020 has been amazing, like absolutely insane, record-breaking, and people of all walks of life who never before thought about owning a firearm are owning firearms now own firearms, and the companies where people get trained are working, you know, they never have openings. They do a lot of classes and they're all full classes. So it's it seems kind of against the numbers to me for governors to be campaigning on gun control. I find that a little bit strange after the authoritarianism that they've displayed and the lack of resilience to federal tyranny and outside of the country mandates and driven mandates, tyranny, you know, like WHO, for example, United Nations, World Economic Forum. It's just, I don't really understand. I guess maybe it's the mail-in ballots. Maybe that's why we have politicians everywhere that are now just behaving for the last couple of years like Cartman, you know, they'll do what they want. And, you know, F anybody that doesn't agree because they're Cartman and they don't care because, yeah, they don't need to worry about getting elected anymore. They can just drop piles of mail-in ballots off.
See, that's the weird thing about Abrams. No matter what you do, you would have to so horribly steal the election for her because she's anti-gun. And she's not somebody who's in office. She doesn't have an office. She's now going to take a second run at governor in a state where there's no way in hell you are getting elected as an anti-gun candidate. For the state. You might be get in Atlanta. You might get in there for a term or two as mayor. You might get in Savannah. You might get in a place, well, honestly, even like where I live, where you might be able to get in there for a term or two as a mayor. The state itself is going to reject that. Red, blue, it doesn't really matter. Everybody's got a gun in Georgia, baby. I mean, this is just stupid. This is the thing I didn't understand about her, and I really was upset that the Libertarian candidate, Ted Metz, in, you know, the year that she ran against Perdue, last time, she couldn't win despite the fact that Perdue clearly was in a serious conflict of interest. The Secretary of State at the time, he was, running the election, was running for governor. How do you not beat that? I'll tell you how you don't beat that, is that they're like, I know he's cheating, but she's going to take the guns. You're done. Georgia, you're not going to get elected. Are you stupid? I keep asking. But I guess somebody is, because even though she's got experienced campaign workers and everything else, nobody thought that was a bad image. It's clearly staged with all the kids. She's got no mask on. They have masks. Duh. You're an idiot from your own position. Why? It's like, hi, I'm here to lose. How you doing? Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you're here to lose because what? Racism? All right, fine. Maybe you're here to lose because the culture, black, white, any other color you want to identify a person as in Georgia, is not anti-gun. They will. That's one of those key points. No. Okay? It's just not going to work. And I'm from, I grew up in a state where gun control was a thing. And totally understand that attitude up there a bit. I know how it works. I never really agreed with it, but you know what? I lived with it, and quite frankly, a couple of years after I got into Georgia, though, I didn't have firearms in my house first couple of years. I didn't. You know why? I didn't think I needed them. And as time has gone on, I'm thinking it would be better if I had them. So I have changed my mind. It's my right to do that, to have them or not have them. And this woman wants to, like, eliminate all this stuff. You're out of your mind. I have not met, I don't think, a single person in Georgia, okay, Democrat, Republican, whatever, Trumper, it doesn't matter. I don't think I've met a single person in Georgia that doesn't at least have a shotgun in their house. Okay, what are you doing? It's a big question. Anyway, I'm sorry. But the fact that this is going on, it's hilarious with these guns. Because it's like the people that are trying to assert this in certain places, it's like, okay, so you've decided that even if the votes were completely legitimate, which they hardly ever are, but if they were, you're going to lose. It's a known fact. Why are you bothering then? You know, even half of the guys that would call themselves socialists in Georgia don't want to take anybody's guns. Because it's not part of the deal here. It's not part of the culture. Seriously. And I mean, you can have different cultures in different parts of the country. We do. But this is just stupid. Anyway, I'm sorry, Hesher.
That's totally righteous, man. I agree 100%. I grew up in a state that loves gun control. And I moved to Texas that loves guns. And it's a much more polite society here. And we've got our own version out here. I think his name is Beta O'Rourke, I believe. Man, and he campaigns on taking away people's AR-15s all the time. And, never going to win. It's not going to happen without cheating, buddy. It's just not around here. Maybe mayor of Austin, like you were saying. That could be, but...
Yeah, no, see, that's the thing, though, is if he was the mayor of Austin, I'd say, okay. Mm-hmm. I go, that makes sense. Fine. But, dude, you're going to take guns away from people in Texas?
It's so easy to spot people from other states, too. If they have a Beto sticker on their car, it means they're from another state. They probably go to one of the colleges here, or they came here from another state and didn't read the sign on the way in that said, don't bring your broken politics here that ruined your other state. Welcome.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that Georgia's even that sophisticated. I'm just saying there's simple facts here. You know, anyway, it doesn't matter. Hesher, I leave it to you to close out the hour. Whatever your final thought is, go for it. But I'll tell people that they should go over to Alternate Current Radio, check out what he's got going over there. Not just him, obviously, but the other hosts that are there, which I mentioned at the beginning of the hour. If you weren't listening, go back, rewind it, listen to it. And, that's that. Maybe one of these days we'll get back together on some of those other little projects we were doing, too. And who knows? Maybe you'll appear more than just on the Monday over here. All options are on the table with you, Hesher. So we'll see what you have time to do as you're building what you're building over there.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me. I love my Monday night appearances on the Ocelli Effect. Thanks, everybody out there at Ocelli.com. Be sure and check them out if you're listening to this on my podcast stream. I'm the host of The Boiler Room at AlternateCurrentRadio.com. Check out that show if you haven't, and all the other shows at the website. And yeah, thanks for giving me the final words tonight, Chuck. And I'll tell everybody to remember to keep the door to your heart open and keep your guns cocked.
I can't disagree with you there. In the next hour, we'll be talking to the artist currently known as Terry Tapp. So stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
Revelation through conversation.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
When a fan of the Ocelli Effect calls in to the Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and JP Sicilian and all of the guests that you have how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone. I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have okay. No idea.
Thanks. And most of our fans just send hate mail and death threats.
Ocelli.com.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
The views expressed by callers, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
Ocelli.com.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com. Of course, you could be hearing us some other time, some other place, and we welcome you no matter where that is. Could be some other announcements coming up about where it is. You'll be able to hear us soon, but can't get there just yet. Plus a new show added to the regular network. So, I don't know. A lot of things going to happen in 2022. And somebody else that I know has things happening in 2022 is the artist currently known as Terry Tapp. Of course, that's a really bad description of the man who is quite diverse in the things he's done. I could say he's an author. I could say he's an artist. I could say that he is a social commentator of sorts. I could say that he's a writer in other ways. I could say that he's a storyteller. I could say a lot, but I just have a lot of fun talking to him and haven't been able to do it as often so far in the past few months as I would like to have, but he's been a little busy, and we had to move last week's show to tonight. So, you know, we'll go back to that regular rotation where we hear from them every other Tuesday, Monday, excuse me, hopefully soon. And anyway, he's with me tonight. Terry, first off, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, man. Yeah, it's not a bad year so far, you know.
Well, it's not a bad year, but you're in a strange place because, after all, you're in New York still, right?
Yeah, of course. I don't see myself ever completely severing ties with New York City.
You know, when you live there, that is the kind of feeling you get, where it's like, I can't see why I would ever completely leave or not be nearby New York, because it's a unique place. And you're a unique guy, by the way. If people go over to terrytapp.com, which I'll give you the link to go over there, I think the website will have some updates coming up soon. But also, I got a link for Mysterioso Books. And in fact, before we get to the uniqueness in New York, you're almost ready to drop a book through Mysterioso.
The first book is out. And
it's out.
The first episode of the podcast, which is on that book, is not up yet, but you can order the book. In fact, a ton of people have been ordering it. It is a poetry chapbook. So just to give you a heads up, it's a poetry chapbook by a fellow who's a political commentator, very widely known political commentator. You can Google him and find things. I really enjoy him. He's another Southern guy. He's from Georgia. And has traveled around the world, lived in Egypt, lived in Mexico, lived in Korea. Fascinating guy. And he wrote a book of poetry. He's actually written a number of them, but this is one of them. It's called Liberation and All the Other Bright, Etc. And cover is actually by me, charcoal drawing, which you'll see on the website. And that's what it is. Like I said, without even fully announcing it on the website or linking the podcast to it, it's selling a lot, actually.
Nice. Well, look, do me a favor and email me the podcast link when it comes out, because I love to share stuff like that around, and sure, love to get people into this book. And I know you talked about this guy a little bit on a previous show, but we spent a lot more time talking about another piece that you're working on, which will take a little bit of time to get to, the guy with the zine, and he talks about his life and all that. We talked a lot more about that. Unique character, and it's going to be interesting when that comes out as well. I refer you back to the earlier podcast, you the listener, not you, Terry. back to the earlier podcast where we did discuss this. But in the meantime, it's interesting that you're talking about the uniqueness, the sort of unique connection that you wind up with if you are somebody who is kind of in the artistic or creative realm when you're in New York City. This is the best way I can put it. You wind up feeling connected, and it doesn't matter where you came from. to give you an idea of the, you know, the sort of diverse nature of people that you might end up, you know, just interacting with. At a certain point, when I lived in New York City, I was running a small record company, and I was still a heavy metal musician. But the guy that I hung out with the most was actually a guy who composed ballets and stuff, who was, you know, there working for a ballet company. They paid for his apartment. The guy was from Spain originally. And he was really an interesting cat. I loved hanging out with him. The two of us just sort of found each other in a bar at one point, because it was like, hey, look, two guys with long hair in a bar in New York City. That was kind of strange in the 90s for some reason. Okay. So we just hung out and did our thing and all. But it's a very weird connection you feel to a city that is living and breathing around you. And it's been through some stuff here, man. It's been through some stuff with the pandemic, the restrictions, the political upheaval. I'm curious how you feel about it currently, because it looks like it's getting a little weird to me with Eric Adams coming in, and maybe there's going to be attitudes changing, and the plainclothes police are coming back, which is not good news for those of us who knew what they used to do, but he swears it'll be different this time. But aside from the politics, there's a living and breathing energy that you get steeped in as a creative person in New York City, which I got to say, I've been to many cities in America, many major ones, minor ones. I live in a minor one now. And I got to tell you that there's a unique character to New York City that is simultaneously inspirational and also seemingly addictive and becomes almost part of your personality when you're there. So what do you think about that idea?
Well, New York City, the interesting thing about it is it's the most diverse city on the planet. And you get a lot of immigrants. You get a lot of that energy. And it's also, I found during my lifetime at least, New York City is where change globally happens first. Mm-hmm. So if you want to know what your society is going to be 10 years from now, 5 years from now, sometimes not even that, come to New York City and you see that. All the social changes for better and worse, political changes, everything seems to happen here first. I know that's been said before, but it's true. And, you know, with this pandemic, I think one thing about it is that the devastation that has happened to New York City has been spreading. Mm-hmm. You know, initially it was just New York City that was squashed. And now it's moved out from New York City to the rest of the country. And, I know a lot of people across the world and talk to people across the world, but I also have this concentration of hillbillies, people in West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia. And it's interesting to me to pair off what friends of mine who are making art in Hong Kong or Berlin are telling me versus what's going on with the hillbillies. Mm-hmm. And I don't say it disparagingly. I put myself in both classes, actually. But to compare those social, political, and economic changes with what's happening now and what has been happening in New York City are fascinating. You know, I know recently my father has gotten very interested in examining, I guess you would say, political and economic systems. He's uneducated. He was a laborer most of his life. But his reading has been ramping up and up and up. Okay, so the quality of his reading, and now he can pose a lot of questions about capitalism, socialism, things like that, in a more sophisticated, more beneficial manner, beneficial to getting answers. And I know that he sent me some text recently about things going on in Kentucky, and about some of the reading material and podcasts that I had suggested that he was looking at. And he pointed out that what people were commenting on even 5 years ago as a critique of capitalism doesn't make sense today. And I said, yeah, you know, we're in a very unique, unknown time. It has echoes of post-Civil War, post-1918 Spanish flu, but it doesn't as well. And there are reasons why it doesn't. And you could see that happening in New York City. You begin to see it happening in, like, now in Kentucky. But you see all those. And it's hard to move away from that front row seat of change, for better and worse. As I said, sometimes, like with the pandemic, it's just ugly. But you see the wealthy buying up things. You see the wealthy acquiring a lot of abandoned businesses, for instance. You see the change from a market-based capitalism to something that's more like a platform-based techno-feudalism. Mm. And, and you see the changes in the workforce, people's attitudes. My dad said, they can't buy a refrigerator. They've saved up money. The refrigerator's barely working. And they can't get a refrigerator because of just the supply of refrigerators in rural Kentucky. I think he said it's been a year and a half trying to get it. You know, so there are these things that were happening in New York City that were only happening, I know, at least from talking with people, they weren't experiencing them. And now they're happening all over the country. So that's fascinating to know that you're in that front row seat for gore and joy. Gore, right. Gore. But, one interesting thing about the city is, as the wealthy have been devouring more and more of our lives and the planet, the city keeps experiencing an influx of immigrants, which pushes against that dynamic. And how that will play out, I don't know. But you definitely see, like in Manhattan, chunks of Manhattan are dead. The wealthy have bought them. They've put the same businesses there, or no businesses. I found out that those blocks of high-end blight, they call it, where you have a lot of very expensive properties that are for rent, are actually being subsidized by taxpayers in a complex real estate maneuver. It's almost hard to explain. But basically, if you have if you have a property and it's at a certain level of expense and it's in a neighborhood that has that level and yours is either the highest or the lowest, it's something like that, and you don't rent it for a certain number of months, the city will pay you. This lady who does real estate explained this to me. It was very complicated. And I said, The upshot of all this is that me working, you working, finances the billionaires. And she said, yes, you understood through all that. So you'll see places in New York City that are utterly dead, and if there's anything to them at all, it's boring. The big Halloween store down on 4th Avenue is closing. You know, like a lot of funkiness is being destroyed. And you see this in other cities in the country. But here you see, like I said, dead blocks in Manhattan that have just been acquired. And they've been acquired by, these ghostly people. Mm-hmm. One in Abu Dhabi, you know, someone in London, the city of London, someone who, you know, has estates upstate that's just grabbed up property.
A couple of Chinese billionaires probably, you know, just along with it.
Well, you see it with farmland in the U.S. You know, this this doesn't mean well. I mean, you can't have a planet run this way. But you see this directly. You know, and I've actually, one job that I've swooped down into at different times to win art sales and things that aren't bubbling the way I want, or I need money for family beyond tattooing and selling paintings. And that is working with art transport, art handling. And I've actually been in the estates of billionaires. I've been in the Trump Plaza, whatever you call it, penthouse of one of America's richest families. Right. You know, so you get to see these people. You get to see how they live. You get to actually talk to them in these places. And for the most part, they're ghouls. And so, you see the people who are acquiring the farmland in your country, who are acquiring the blocks of your city. You know, it's fascinating. Just today, for instance, I wanted this year to be very stable. And I took an extra job, a job as a carpenter.
Right.
So this job is in East New York. I'll try not to give much of it away because they're decent people, actually, the folks I'm working for. It's in East New York, which is in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And East New York is one of the poorest spots in all of New York City. It's dilapidated. Whatever. It is everything you'd expect given that statement. Well, yeah. I'm boxing up high-end works of art, okay? Most of these, frankly, are crap. Most of the other people there are artists, and we see the works as we're boxing them up, creating them, building, structures around them. They're junk, but they're probably produced, knowing how this works, by some Lord or Lady Fauntleroy who went to Yale or went to RISD,
yeah.
And family bought this. And they turn it into a commodity. They box it up and they store it so it can accrue in value. Just today, I was boxing up what appeared to be some pretty dull, pretty basic lampshades. Mm-hmm. And then I realized along with them is a doggy bed and a street sign. The other carpenter I'm working with, I asked him, I said, this is just someone's living room crap. They didn't want to move it. He said, yeah, they're super rich. They just, rather than putting things in the back of their car, they call an extraordinarily expensive crating service as part of an art handling business to move their $45 lampshade. Okay. These are people. Now, just take that. So they're spending thousands to move a lampshade, a doggy bed, a little sign, you know, that you're going to hang in your living room. I go to get lunch, and, you know, I'm walking through streets filled with trash, feces. There are junkies at the little, what is a little deli. You know, guys just trying to get a little fix of alcohol right beside it.
Yeah, guys hovering around a convenience store, as they often do, because somebody might have made change inside. You got something to spare, this kind of thing. And they'll be there all day because, you know, frankly, they might go find themselves an abandoned property later to sleep in. But that's what they're doing because that's what they're doing. And that's the, yeah, I got the scene here. Sure, and that's where you decide to go get a sandwich or something, right?
Right.
Okay.
Contrast that with what I'm doing. I'm being paid pretty well, actually, and working with nice people. I won't in any way detract from that situation.
Yeah.
To build crates around some Lord Fauntleroy's lampshade that he couldn't be bothered to move. This guy has enough money, or his daddy or mommy has enough money to lay out to spare him that 1 minute of work of going to his car and putting the lampshade in, putting the dog bed. One, it was just a dog bed, a wooden dog bed, in. Just chew on that for a minute. You know, I was thinking about how, and it's not to branch off from New York, but looking at the contrast in New York. And in fact, the one person with whom I'm working had moved here from San Francisco, and we were talking about San Francisco. And I love the history of it. And I went to a couple of comic conventions and hung out with some amazing artists, had amazing times there up until like 2014.
Okay.
And he said, you know, it's terrible because people there, you have this slice of people that own San Francisco, and they're so ridiculously rich, it's deformed everyone else. And he's just throwing this out there. We didn't know each other that well at the time. And he said, and plus, it's California's on fire all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know these things. And he said, you know, New York's bad, but not as bad as San Francisco, it seems. And I think what he's referring to is the fact that New York's 9 million people and San Francisco's about 900,000.
Right.
I walked east to west across San Francisco, which is still beautiful. But you really feel the inequality and the boot on your neck from that inequality. So,
well, a quick contrast here, Terry, just real fast, is that you're being paid to move stuff that's not even really expensive, okay, and to do it in a boutique sort of way. And the fact is, what they're paying you is probably more than the cost to replace every stick of furniture in my house. If I wanted to move to a new house and buy everything that I have already again, it would cost me less to do that than to pay you to move it. But let's have you move it because that'll be the way to go. It's almost strange, like, you know, there's no even thought of an economy. Like, there's different levels here you could go. You could pay a mover who's just a regular mover. You can go rent your own U-Haul and then go to the website and see if you can hire these guys for a day that they have there that are just looking for gig work, right? You can rent your own U-Haul and move your own stuff, usually about the level I'm at best.
Back up, man, you said something very important.
Go ahead.
And I don't want to branch off of New York City, but you said something. There's no thought of the economy in this.
Right.
And that's the important thing because, you know, we live together. You live in my world. I live in your world. Mm-hmm. We live in the world occupied by these billionaires. We live in the world occupied by these junkies. We're all people, and we live here. Right. So there has to be this thought that I am doing something that in some way affects you, just like this guy with whom I'm working, being affected by this inequality in San Francisco. You're affected. If you see me and I'm eating very well, you see inside my kitchen, and you're starving, that affects you, and I should be taking into account that there is a starving man outside my window, and I have like three turkeys on the table, and I can't eat even one. That's a big deal. You have to take into account that those guys are on the street, a dirty street, with dog crap and human crap and trash next to this, as you said, the situation in which Lord Fauntleroy can't even be bothered to move his living room furniture, mm-hmm. and he's paying the extraordinarily expensive art handling service to do so. Okay, this is the thing. It's one state of being in which you have rich people and you have poor people and you have scrambling, restless, you know, insecure people in between those two. It's another thing when you have such a mind-numbing level of inequality that you detach or attempt to detach from the rest of the world. You know, I'm working on a comic piece right now. Finished the comic piece for an anthology. Mm-hmm. The comic piece, the anthology is for World War III Illustrated, which is one of, if not the longest running comics anthology in the U.S. And I get invited to contribute, and it's an honor. Really like doing this. They wanted a piece on repair. That was the theme, repair. They actually, after never missing an issue since 1979, they missed a year during the pandemic. They didn't know, like, how do we address this?
Right.
So this year's anthology is on the theme of repair, repairing the world, repairing your life, repairing your city, your neighborhood, whatever. The piece I contributed to it is an 8-page black and white piece, and it deals with looking at people who claim to own the planet. They claimed at one time to own what's around them. They claimed to own people in Africa. They claimed to own people in this land. They claimed to own the lands in Europe with the Enclosure Acts. And now they appear to claim to own the entire planet.
Right.
I break away from that and talk about, you know, in 2019 when I went to the United Nations for this climate restoration forum, the first one, and how we could easily solve, not easily, but we can solve most of the problems related to climate catastrophe that are occurring.
Okay.
These scientists made these appeals. It's all wonderful, and you can research this, climate restoration forum. Yet, none of these things are being pushed by these pathological acquisitors, the owners. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder if they've actually pushed away from pathological acquisition to a ritual of death, to almost a service of the god of death. Mm-hmm. That's the point. These people, there's not a thought of an economy. If you have the kind of money our billionaire class does, or even high-end millionaire at this point, versus how little most people have. Just take the United States. I mean, there are poorer places and there are richer places, but definitely just take this country. Look at what little most people have here, compared to these folks that own entire cities now, that can transform the world in a day, with a snap of their fingers. It's not an economy. You know, a friend called me couple of days ago and was asking some questions. He's writing a piece and talking about the coverage of the Vietnam War in American history textbooks, which is just mind-numbingly fallacious. They're actually, like, some of these textbooks essentially imply we won. The level of stupidity and just lying.
God.
It's insane. So, yeah, or, well, whatever. We'll leave that.
Well, no, don't leave that for a second, because you know what? This is exactly what goes on. Is after a while, history is sanitized, quite frankly, to such a degree that it's irrecognizable to the reality that was. And the Vietnam War we won? I mean, you know, I thought it was bad enough when they were saying poor Lyndon Johnson was pushed into this. You know, it was bad enough when Ken, what's his name, the most boring filmmaker that keeps getting funded for PBS constantly, I forget his name at this point, but you know who I'm talking about, does his Vietnam series. You got to be kidding me with what it is they're turning it into. I'm watching this in real time knowing that, you know, you and I watch people come home. Get the hell out of here with this revision. Okay, you want to revise? Then get to the truth about the things that were hidden. Okay, I get it. But trying to hide more of the things that are the truth, this is the business of those that will write those history textbooks. And your friend's piece, I want you to send me a link to it if it's done, because I'd love to see it.
Notes. But, Yeah, I've heard this kind of thing from other people, but here's how I attach what I'm talking about now with this, what I was saying. You know, there's no need for an economy anymore. You have these people that almost completely, outrightly own the planet. They don't care what Chuck O'Chelly or Terry Tapp or anyone else thinks. You know, we have peanuts, and there are people even below us. So we're irrelevant to this. They don't care what they teach the children because the buttons that that need to be pushed are going to be pushed by machines. So they're not worried if you live in a complete fantasy land, which most Americans do now. They don't care about any of this. What we would assume is an economy or assume is a political state of affairs is purely detached from the machinations of the functioning of a country, the functioning of a global economy, the functioning of anything that touches onto a real state of being. So now you have, you know, I was talking to my daughter about this. I said, what was the coverage of 9/11? You know, when you're in high school? She said, well, they mentioned that it happened and they described like the events. Here's a thing that happened. Why did it happen? Well, that's not discussed. It happened. It's complicated. And you need to know that these were the dates. These people were killed. But there's no discussion of why it happened. And that's why I was telling this buddy. He said, you know, they're not outrightly saying we won the Vietnam War. But there's this understanding that Vietnam is a capitalist country. They do trade, which they're not. They're socialist. But they trade with capitalist countries. We trade with them, so everything's okay. It was just this smoothing over, and mainly because you don't matter. You don't need to know. Just like this guy coming back from San Francisco, he sees that the wealthy own the majority of San Francisco. Then you have the Mission, the Tenderloin, and other places, people scrambling for pennies. Right. Just like here in New York, these junkies, you know, and I hate even calling them junkies. They're people. I've got people in my family that are junkies and prostitutes and, you know, Trailer Park, Kentucky. But at the same time, and I'm not in any way dogging them. I'm just saying they have names and they, you know, they didn't choose to do what they do. They struggled with trauma. They struggled with the despair of poverty. They struggled with trying to find a way to keep eating. And so eventually they work into, you know, doing things that keep them doing these activities. And it's hard, you know, it's heartrending.
Well, see, and that's another thing I want to pause you on, because look, I have tried to explain this over and over again, that people are very judgmental about, you know, what it is that somebody else does to stay alive. And I, you know, it sounds really trite. It sounds really, you know, cliche. But here's the truth. Until you've been there and in their situation, you don't know what that decision making was. Because this person decided to be a junkie. This person decided to be a prostitute. You know what? You don't recognize when you're making a statement like that. And I don't mean you, Terry. I mean people that make statements like that. They don't recognize the path that it took to get there at all. Because there are sometimes, quite frankly, you might not have lived in this world, and bless you if you never did, but there are times when you are confronted with there may only be a certain level of options available to you. In truth, it's not like, well, other people can bootstrap themselves out. You know what kind of a fairy tale that is? In reality, there might be temporary spots in your life where you might have had to do certain things you didn't really want to do. But, you know, for you, it might have been going to school. You know what I'm saying? For somebody else, though, who is presented with, look, tomorrow there's nothing to eat. Tomorrow there's no roof over your head. Tomorrow. That means today I better do something. And when you take a look at what's easily accessible to you, you wind up making decisions that you wouldn't make, all things being equal. And right. I don't know how to relate that to some people, but it's part of the reality. And you know what? You and I have talked personally off the air. You know that I've been there. I know that, you know, on some level, so have you. And you've witnessed it in other people. You recognize this. But there are some people that, you know what? Bless them. They have no clue about that choice. They have no clue about exactly what is limited to you. And it is not that I'm taking all the fault away from everybody who ever decided. No, I'm just telling you that unless you have actually been on the same path as the individual you're judging, you might want to consider it. I don't mean you again, Terry. I'm saying that in general, this needs to be recognized. So I'm sorry. Please continue.
Well, to back this up to the very beginning of what we're saying, and New York City is paradigmatic of change. You have these grand changes that begin here, in part, I think, because of the money and the influx of people from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you talk about these things, prostitution, sex work, I guess we should say, and, you know, drug abuse and things like this, dire situations. Mm-hmm. And both of us have, if we haven't been there, you know, we've got family members and friends in it. So, yeah, we come from that background. Okay. And I've had the joy, I guess, a privilege of moving in between many different social classes and professions and such, and have been around very wealthy people and talking with them, and upper middle class people, and upper middle class white people, and upper middle class black people, people of color, and very poor people of whatever so-called race, and on and on. And I've heard these fairy tales, you know, about how people get places, and usually getting higher is and great achievements are because of mommy and daddy's money, and usually a struggle is because you didn't have any safety net at all, and maybe you were kicked as well. But what I'm looking at now in New York City, and with my friend talking about San Francisco, is you're looking at a world that just doesn't need you. Mm-hmm. The wealthy have taken it to such a level before the pandemic, but during the pandemic, taken inequality to such a level that it doesn't matter if you know the Vietnam War happened. It certainly doesn't matter if you think we won. It doesn't matter if you think we lost. It doesn't matter if you blame Robert McNamara. It doesn't matter if you want to kiss his back end. Nothing matters. It doesn't matter if you support Trump or don't support Trump or support Biden. It doesn't matter what you think. Your world is owned. Our world, my world, is owned. You can really feel that at places here in the city. Just the horrible contrast of people, empty, hungry ghost people who live to acquire. They're not artists. They're not creators. They're not thinkers. They just acquire. They're like a bag of rats disguised as a human skin. And they soak it all down. And then you have other people. And when you see a guy and he's outside, exactly as you depicted, actually, outside a store hoping you got a little extra pocket change so he can get, you know, a little Hennessy or whatever he needs to keep from thinking about his ugly life, yeah, that's actually you. Because if the problem with that guy is he wasn't needed for a while, he might have lost his job. You know, and he goes on the street. We've all got, well, a lot of us have these stories of other people, sometimes us. But maybe, you know, somebody gets a moment of despair and starts using some pills or whatever they're doing. At some point, not very, very far into the future, they're in a bad situation. But we're all in that bad situation now. And you can really feel that here in the city. People are scrambling. It feels confused, and it feels very different. And if you see some of these wealthy people, which I do, I'm not right now. I see their property, but I've actually gone into their penthouses and such. When you see them and you see what they've got and how they're living and their attitudes, it's insane. You know, about 12 years ago, I was tattooing a NYPD officer, mm-hmm, and some of this came up, but in a much reduced form because it's exploded much further now. And I told him, I said, you know, I just keep thinking of guillotines. I said, you know, there was something in the New York Times that he was referring to that I don't remember, but I said, I don't believe it. And he laughed and he said, you're smart not to believe it. He said, they don't give a rat's behind about you or me. He said, I have moonlight at this club in Manhattan. And the club is full of these wealthy men that come in And I don't know the name of the club, if it had a name, whatever. But he said, you know, they hire some police officers for security off duty. And he said, they make jokes about not paying taxes and how they're just, you know, taking a dump on us. And he said, it's really hard to keep my temper listening to them because they're laughing about kids in the street, like not having health care. And I said, yeah. He said, you know, everything you say that you say, I don't believe this. He said, you're spot on, man. He said, they're garbage and they'll roll over us. And oh, yeah. And the example he's using, he said, you know, he read in a book. I know what book it is. He said about a guy in a carriage in London, like running over a kid and tossing a coin down like, hey, sorry about your luck. And I said, yeah, Charles Dickens. And I remember this conversation. But that situation is where we are now. You know, I was listening to a podcast just to add more fuel to this. And on this podcast, very good podcast. I should give a shout out to it. But they're reading from a book by Engels, you know, Marx and Engels. Right. Piece of Engels wrote about housing. If you close your eyes, don't know that it's by Frederick Engels, don't know the date, you're listening to something that could be talking about New York City right now. You're listening to something that's also beginning to be Columbus, Ohio. It's beginning to be Louisville, Kentucky. It's beginning to be Phoenix, Arizona. Pick your locale. It's so spot on for what we're dealing with that, you know, you see that level of callous inequality returning with a vengeance. And in fact, I was actually listening to this, not reading it, but someone was talking about what was going on in Russia at one point a few years back. And they said, you know, when the wealthy reacquire the lands that had been taken back by peasants in revolt, right, whatever you want to call them, socialist, communist, you know, Bolsheviks, anarchists, they take it back with a vengeance. They rub your nose in it, and they make sure that you have the despair of knowing you'll never be able to take back your land. Mm-hmm. So what we've got now is a situation in which, and this is what I'm seeing in New York, you have a desperate population that's realizing it is not needed on this planet. You know, the jobs, you know, your job is at best precarious. You know, what I'm doing right now is not precarious only because there's so many variables that I don't see how a robot would be able to do it.
Right.
But this is, you know, there's this phrase that goes around left-wing circles, right-wing circles, the New World Order. And I heard it as a kid, and I was attracted to it and researched it. My take on it, ultimately, is that the New World Order, which is what we're really seeing finally unfold in all of its glory, is the ultimate separation of labor and capital.
Right.
When capital doesn't need the rest of humanity. And and that's what I'm seeing. So it's coming to other places. Part of what my dad was noticing, and I was telling him, this is this techno-feudalism, platform-based techno-feudalism we're seeing. It's not market-based capitalism, which is pretty much over. It's when the super wealthy own these giant platforms, basically, Facebook or whatever, you know, type of app or whatever way in which business is conducted itself as a foundation, not just the market. You're unnecessary for it. I'm unnecessary.
Right.
Doesn't matter what art you're making. You know, I was talking with a guy, he's on a podcast, one of my episodes that's yet to be released. He's a veteran of the English Army, UK Army, and he's got this organization trying to help stop evictions in Cornwall. He said he was talking about artists, and he said, you know, a lot of these artists are just rich kids now. I told him, I said, this is a situation that existed at one time. There were these revolutions that slowly pushed the dial to a different degree. So you can have a guy who's a bricklayer and his daughter becomes an artist. Or you can have a guy who's a bricklayer, his wife is working as a secretary, and they send their son to college and he becomes a doctor. That's amazing. That didn't happen back when you could throw a coin down to someone when you ran over his kid with your carriage. But now we're in a situation where you can do that. You can have affluenza. you can kill four or five other kids with your car and get out of it because you're a rich kid and you don't know consequences. That's okay. That happens. Mm-hmm. These are cases, as you, I'm sure you, you're aware of.
Oh, yeah.
But situation where you can't be an artist. You can't be a doctor. These things are being cut away from us. And you see that here. You know, anyway, that I'm trying to make a point that's big, difficult, and in a way very simple.
No, I totally understand. And, of course, the disparity and the disconnection of, you know, capital versus labor. I mean, we go back to the genesis of this. Of course, this has a lot to do with the monetary system as it exists, the way that the central banking system has come together, and all of these things coalesce into right. what it is we're seeing today. And in fact, I understand also your attraction to the idea of the New World Order, because clearly there are people in control of the situation that are not among the common folk. And it's just that simple. The ownership and the attitude of ownership that comes along with it is clearly discernible at this time. And for anybody to think that there is not a sort of a global conspiracy that does revolve around this concept of death, I think is just naive at best. Because
well, you know, conspiracy, I have to say this, man, because this is startling to me. You know, for years I did research on more clandestine conspiracies. Right. And I contacted booksellers to look at hard-to-find volumes on Masonry and the Knights Templars and all this stuff.
Of course.
And there's a lot of truth to some of it. It's some of it's fantasy. It's very mixed. But at this point, if you go to websites looking at the Club of Rome or any of these kind of organizations, Bilderberg, I mean, it's not like there's one group out there. There are many, and they're very brazen about how they speak. You know, someone was talking about the Great Reset and someone making certain comments and asked me my opinion on it. I said, it's everywhere. You can look from Bill Gates to Bilderberg to Club of Rome. You can go through, you know, reports from the UN. Like, it's everywhere and brazen because they don't care. They don't care what you think. They don't care what I think. If they want to talk, you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski had a book called The Great Chess Game.
Right.
And I saw this as a kid, and I thought, how would you be so ballsy to speak about politics like this? Just look at what you're saying, The Great Chess Game. There are no pieces. There are people, and those people live in masses of land, and they have social organizations of various sorts. So how do you have the cojones to speak openly of a great chess game as politics? But now, that's nothing. If I told someone about the Club of Rome, mm-hmm. that came to mind, and he looked up their website, and he was startled. Yes, they're openly talking about these things. Someone was talking about, you know, plots to simulate a vaccine, an epidemic and things. Mm-hmm. And it's true, whether it actually coincidentally or not coincidentally dovetails into what we're seeing now, it doesn't really matter. There, but all this is being discussed across the board because you're not needed.
Yeah.
I'm not needed.
Yeah,
and that's the thing. There used to be this need to have a class of intellectuals, a class of people, and by intellectual I just mean people that had some understanding of the way things work, because the people in charge, the people who are rolling around on their gold coins, the rat people, the hungry ghosts, they don't know all of this. They need to know what buttons need to be pushed at what time. And so you have to have people that understand mathematics, that understand physics, that even have some sociological understanding. And, of course, at some level, to keep the populace from killing you, they need to have artists, musicians, things, people of this sort. Now they don't need those things. They have the ability to automate. They have the ability to function without the rest of the species. And apparently they're going to take us all up the great windpipe of extinction by their pathological acquisition. because they're not addressing dealing with the very real environmental collapse in, precipitated in large part by their behavior. It's not your fault. You know, people talk about driving your car or not recycling. I mean, these are valid things. But in the grand scheme of things, no, it's these industries and what they've done. Giant industries owned by a few individuals.
Well, see, with the last couple of minutes, Terry, I have a major question here. And this is where I keep coming to, and I don't want to keep coming to this conclusion, but I keep coming to it anyway. Is the transhumanist agenda really the thing that is the end game? Because at the end of the day, you don't need any of us if everything is automated and the computers can fix themselves. You don't need anything. You can just, what, upload yourself into the singularity. I mean, is that what the end goal is? It's just no longer necessary. I don't need breathable air if my consciousness can be held in a mainframe. I don't, you know, as long as we have some sort of renewable power, it's okay. You know, this is the contention of some people, and I'm not sure if it's right, but at the end of the day, it's the only logical thing. Because destroy the planet, destroy your fellow creature, destroy everybody else, and, you know, even the depopulation agendas and all this stuff. I'm not saying that I'm 100% on board with all of it, but it's ringing a lot more true as I watch these things unfold. And certainly you can observe, you know, the whole Gates funded thing, the Event 201. You can observe the other discussions that happened in the 1980s about needing to introduce a pandemic. You can take a look at these other game theories by these different think tanks. And it does seem as though all of these other things that people always felt, well, for one reason or another, they'll still need slaves. Not really. If you can get into the fully automated reality and ghost, it's interesting you use the term ghost, because I keep talking about the ghost world that is being formed in the virtual, where, you know, there's virtual land, there's virtual business, there's virtual currency, and nothing ever needs to be solid again, including you.
Well, see, here's the thing, man. We're talking about loading up your consciousness into a mainframe. I think that's largely just fantasy. And I say that not just from speculation, but from having done some actual research and publishing in neuroscience and cognitive science. I think that's fantastic. I think what you have, you know, let me back up. Douglas Rushkoff, the writer and blogger, a fantastic writer, actually, he published about 10 years ago a letter recounting a meeting he had. And this, everyone should look this up. It's fascinating. He was asked if he would give a speech to some very rich people about what they could do to avoid climate catastrophe. So he said, you know, he teaches in London. He's got family, his family there. He's a father. And he said they were going to pay me for this one lecture, what I make as a lecturer per year. So, of course, he's going to do this. And he said, I expected to go into a lecture hall, as you would as a professor, and have 300 people there.
Right.
No, he went into a room with about 8 guys in nice suits. And they talked to him. These are billionaires. They talked to him about their fears. And he said, you know, your fears are justified. And he said, here's what I would do. I would spend whatever I have to do to address these environmental problems. I would also address women's health. I would address work problems. I would address income inequality. I would, you could go through this list. You would basically transform society into something in which we want to live, in which we cooperate, in which no one wants to cut your throat because they don't have enough to eat. And he's more sophisticated than what I'm saying now, but you can read it. He wrote this out.
Fair enough.
He said, this is how you survive climate change. He said, you deal with it directly, scientifically, and you transform society.
Okay.
That's the way. And they said, absolutely not. We were looking at bunkers, New Zealand or Alaska, and basically taking a cadre of slaves, essentially, but doctors, servants of various sorts, entertainers with us. So you basically have your own little planet in microcosm, right. And it's on your base in Alaska or in New Zealand or wherever. And this has been happening. Even people like Robert Reich, just about 5 or 6 years ago, reporting about all the wealthy buying up land in New Zealand. So aside from loading up consciousness into mainframes and all this other stuff, these are just very miserable people that don't seem to have any life at all other than grabbing things, you know, and they are looking at the possibility of having a world in which they don't need the majority of humanity. They will need somebody, but not many. And, you know, that you don't even need to push the sci-fi past what we're seeing right now. I've gone into these billionaires' penthouses mm-hmm. and actually had conversations with them, and they're atrociously stupid. Like one guy, just to give one example, I was bringing a sculpture that was mounted to this horizontal platform into this very wealthy apartment complex in New York City. All right. Just to give you an idea, I'm this hillbilly artist, but I've done a million things, and you know who I am. The guy with whom I'm working has studied with Zizek, Slavoj Zizek, was the personal assistant to Sylvia Lotringer, who just passed away this November, who you should look up, who's an amazing person, a giant influence on global culture and American culture, but leaving that where it is. Yeah. So this guy is fantastic. So we go... We have these measurements, and the measurements are for this freight elevator, so the sculpture won't fit. Well, the measurements were provided by the billionaire to whose place we're taking it. He can't use a tape measure. Mm. So the billionaire comes down, and he's this none of this is inherently bad, so I don't mean it that way, but he's this soft, small guy with these weird little pointed leather shoes. I don't know why this is a detail stuck in my mind.
Okay.
But he comes down, and he has these soft, small hands. I'm not trying to, if you got small hands, somebody's got small hands, that's fine, whatever. But okay. These are just details that I found annoying about him.
Fair enough.
So he's got his hands, he's flipping his hair, and he goes, this is the problem. This is the problem. He goes, I'm a very rich man. He goes, hey, you're not. You're working, right? Right. He said, this is the problem. You can't be an individual. Be an individual. Think for yourself. What would you do? You're confronted with a problem. You solve the problem. And I could barely speak because I thought, you know what I would do? I'd learn to use a tape measure.
Right. But
aside from that, my coworkers, well, I won't say his name. He said, you know, we could remove this. Oh, well, that's what the guy, he said, remove it. And Spencer said, we can't remove it from its support because we're constrained by insurance. This is a very expensive sculpture. Mm-hmm. This all like everything we do is monitored. We have to document it because right. there's insurance all the way through to the install.
Of course.
And the guy goes, think for yourself. So insurance. Well, I won't obey the insurance. You know, and I'm just getting tired of the guy. My buddy said, I'm going to call headquarters, see what's going on. And he's like, you make a mistake, you fix your mistake. And I kept grinding my teeth thinking, you made the mistake, Cretan. You know, it's like, it's a tape measure and you mismeasured.
No, so see, I understand all this, but we're running out of time, okay?
And at that point, people are Cretans.
Yeah.
And I went up to his place. I see he's got a Robert Motherwell painting over the dining table. I asked him about Robert Motherwell. He didn't even know who did it. He knew that it had this value.
Right.
And he had purchased it from an agent based on this value and based on abstract expressionism in America. You know, these are monstrous people.
See, anyway, sorry. But no, but the contrast I want to offer here, because we're about to be totally out of time, is this. Martin Rothblatt. You know who that is, right?
I do not.
I suggest you look her up. She was a he at birth, but one of the most genius of the moneyed class there is. And the creator of Sirius Satellite Radio and stuff like this. But also, you know, had a child with a health problem, created an organization to create a cure, and did it, right? you know, that's just two points of interest with Martin Rothblatt. Might want to look it up, because they have some of these people that are working on some very strange technology that, you know, again, transcends a lot of things that you and I couldn't even imagine a few years ago.
Right.
And there are people that they do have that are working on things that I'm telling you, man, I know it sounds like Star Trek, you know, we need people to run the machines and all that, or maybe we don't. I know, but I'm telling you, there's other levels here, and I get what you're saying, and the majority of the moneyed class is probably just like your friend in the pointy boots.
Yeah.
But they have a cohort in there that's well ahead of all of that, And this is what makes me a little nervous about the possibility of, well, maybe we really aren't needed, and there's a lot of reasons why nobody else will be needed, you know? So, anyway, Terry Tapp, again, terrytapp.com. Look at Mysterioso Books. I'll give you guys links in with the show notes. But I appreciate you for joining me for a full hour tonight, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again in 2 weeks. Anyway, thanks to Hester for being on the first hour, and thanks to all of you. After all, I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.